Good morning. Thank you for having me today. Today I want to talk about the prevalence, persistence, and infiltration of salmonella in East Coast tomato production environments. For the talk today, I'm going to give you a little bit of a background of the problem in the area, talk about our environmental surveillance, and then talk about some of the colonization and internalization work that we're doing with salmonella in tomato plants. So the background. This slide is slightly outdated, but the overall trends remained. We have a problem in recent years of salmonella in produce. And you can see from the slide the major players in this are leafy greens, melons, and tomatoes. And the problem with having salmonella contamination in produce is these things are very hard for us to trace back. It's very difficult to find the source of these contaminations, because they tend to be low contamination events where you don't have very many organisms on or in the produce. They tend to be widely dispersed throughout the supply chain. So perhaps you'll have one or two cases in three or four different states. And the main problem is by the time we discover that there is something going on, the produce is gone. The shelf life of produce is about 2 weeks, and it takes about 2 weeks for us to discover that there is an event occurring in PulseNet. So this is a problem for us. Some of the recent outbreaks that we've had in tomatoes started in about 1988, and we've had an outbreak almost yearly since then. I want to call your attention to several of these outbreaks in 2002, 2005, 6, 7, and 11. All of these have been the same PFG pattern. So PFG is how we determine a subtype of salmonella. And all of these have been the same PFG pattern, what we call commonly pattern 61. And all of these outbreaks have traced back to the same environment, the same major growing region. And this is the growing region we're talking about is in Virginia. It's along the eastern shore. Virginia is the number three producer of tomatoes in the United States. It's behind California and Florida. Most of the tomato production occurs along the eastern shore, which is basically along the Delmarva Peninsula seen here. The tomato production is, they do follow good agricultural practices. They use plastic culture, and that is seen here. So basically, the soils are fumigated and plastic is laid. This prevents the tomatoes from coming into contact with the ground. They use drip irrigation, but the planting of the tomatoes is done by hand. You can see that these tomatoes are strung and staked. That is done by hand. The tomatoes are harvested at the mature green stage. That is also done by hand. Once harvested, the tomatoes are taken to a packing house where they are placed in a dump tank. That is shown here. The dump tank water is chlorinated, so they are following some good agricultural practices and good manufacturing practices. But there are a lot of places where contamination can occur along these lines. Unfortunately, what we need to find out is what are the sources of the contamination? After hitting the packing house and going through the dump tanks, the tomatoes are typically held in a cooler. They are either sent on to a repacker, sent on to a slicer, or sent on directly to the distribution, whoever will be the wholesaler. Oops. Wrong one. Sorry. So, as I mentioned, there are many places where contamination can occur, and we would really like to know what these environmental reservoirs are. So the first part of the talk here that I want to focus on is what we lovingly call Team Tomato. This is basically our environmental surveillance work. So Team Tomato is a three-year study that was conducted in the years 2009 through 2011. It consisted of four trips per summer, June, July, August, and September. And during each of these trips, we went and collected approximately 300 samples that we brought back to the lab and enriched and tested for the presence of salmonella. Where we went to find these samples, we worked in collaboration with Virginia Tech's Eastern Shore Agricultural Research Extension Center, AREC, which is located in Pinter, Virginia. We really like this area because it is surrounded on all sides by commercial tomato fields. So we're able to get onto a research facility and collect environmental samples that are going to have the same native vegetation, the same insects, same wildlife, and same water source as the commercial tomato fields. Whenever we got out to the fields, the types of samples that we collected were, of course, tomato samples. We took tomatoes, the fruits, the blossoms, the stems, and leaves. We took other commodities because there's a lot of research that goes on at AREC for Virginia Tech, and so they would give us samples. We could take various squashes and peppers and melons. We were able to collect weeds, native vegetation, tree foliage, insects, water and sediment samples from the large pond that was there. There's also a creek that feeds or comes out of that pond, and we were able to take samples from that. We got soil from the fields, also any fecal material that we found around the fields or around the pond. Most of the fecal material is avian. There is a resident goose population that lives there year-round. And then anything else that we thought might look suspicious. Whenever we brought these samples back to the lab, we follow what I like to call a modified BAM protocol. So if you're not familiar with the BAM, this is basically several enrichment steps where you take your samples, you put them into a pre-enrichment broth, then you take some of that sample, you put it into a selective enrichment broth, and then you take those and you plate them onto selective media. And all of this is to get the salmonella separated from all the other background microorganisms that are in these samples, because these are environmental samples, so there's a lot of other stuff that is going to be present. We wanted to try and speed up this process because we were bringing back at each trip up to 300 samples. So we wanted to conduct a molecular screen, which was basically a PCR, a real-time PCR analysis. And so that molecular screen was done from the pre-enrichment. So this is actually a very difficult thing to do a molecular screen from, because you have a lot of organisms growing there. You must have a very specific assay that is able to find the salmonella, and you have to worry about inhibitors that may prevent your PCR reaction from occurring. And this is especially true with fecal samples, soil and sediment samples, and amazingly, certain weeds produce inhibitors that will not permit a PCR reaction to occur. Anything that was positive on the PCR reaction, we then went on and we cultured to try and get isolates. So with all this over the 3 years, what did we find? Well, we actually found quite a bit. In 2009, we just needed to see if the molecular screen would work. So we did not do any culturing in 2009. But in 2010 and 2011, we did. Collectively, we isolated 237 isolates of salmonella out of these samples. Most of these were collected in 2011, and I'm going to go into the reasons for that in just a minute. Of the 237 samples, we've analyzed 226 of them by PFGE, and this is what's shown here as one representative PFGE pattern, because many of the isolates were gave identical PFGE patterns. I want to point out that we did find the organisms that we were interested in, the organisms that gave the recurring PFGE outbreaks. Here, pattern 61. This is Salmonella Newport, pattern 61. And interesting, we also found two other Salmonella Newports that are also associated with outbreaks that we've seen in tomatoes. So of the Newports, 30% were pattern 11, 30% were pattern 61, and 12% were pattern 30. So that's actually a very high percentage of Salmonella Newport that is associated with an outbreak, or has been associated with an outbreak previously. The other interesting thing about these isolates was 22.6% of them have not been identified in PulseNet. So each PFGE pattern was submitted to PulseNet so that we could see if it had ever been associated with any sort of outbreak or if it was part of a known cluster. and 22.6% of them have never been seen before in PulseNet. So this either means that these are organisms that do not typically cause infection in humans, or these are organisms that cause such low levels of infections in humans that it just has never caused an outbreak. So I mentioned outbreaks, and we were actually very fortunate whenever we were down there. Excuse me. In 2010, there was a small cluster of illnesses that occurred in DC at one restaurant. Now, this was actually quite interesting because it had all three of the patterns of Salmonella Newport that we commonly see in tomatoes. It had pattern 11, pattern 61, and pattern 30. In 2010, while we were down at the Eastern Shore, we found Salmonella Newport pattern 11. We were very interested in this. We really needed to know, was this the same organism? And to answer that, since the PFG pattern is the same, it suggests that yes, perhaps it is, but we needed a little bit more detail. We decided to do some whole genome sequencing. So we worked with some of the states and we obtained, we obtained clinical isolates from this cluster and we performed whole genome sequencing. And what you can see here on the tree is down here, these are the clinical isolates of pattern 11, and here in red are the environmental isolates that I isolated from the Eastern Shore that were also pattern 11. What I want to point out here is essentially in this cluster that is right here, there's less than 20 base pair differences out of a total of 4 million. There's less than 20 base pair differences between these clinical isolates and these environmental isolates. So essentially, the outbreak strain was found in some goose feces and in creek sediment at AREC. So this is some very strong evidence that we, in real time, have found the outbreak strain. I mentioned in 2011 that we isolated many of our strains, isolates, and the reason for that is in 2010 we saw constantly that if we were going to isolate Salmonella, it was coming out of the creek water or the creek sediment, and we wanted to know, sorry, I believe my allergies are bothering me today. We wanted to know if this was something that was unique to AREC or if this was something that was prevalent along all of the Eastern Shore. And so we decided to go and sample many public access waterways all along the peninsula. And when we did that, actually, we found quite a few strains of Salmonella. Something that to point out, we do see a lot of Newport. And this is a really weird angle for me to look at. We see a lot of Newport in these waterways. Hold on, there's more. And we also see a lot of Javiana. And even though Javiana was not the focus of this research, Javiana is actually quite a problem in the Eastern Shore of Virginia. In speaking to their state epidemiologists, they always yearly have outbreaks and a large number of illnesses due to Salmonella Javiana infections. So this is something that the state of Virginia is quite interested in as well, and we have spoken to them about this data. But the other thing that you notice out of the waterways is we're not just seeing Salmonella Newport and we're not just seeing Salmonella Javiana. We're actually seeing many, many different cerevars with many different PFG patterns. And this really suggests that this is quite a diverse environment. And the water is definitely a reservoir for the Salmonella in this environment. Unfortunately, we do not know what the source of the contamination is. We simply know that the water is a reservoir for it. So our hypothesis of what is going on down there is that contaminated water may be used to irrigate and it may be mixed with pesticides and herbicides, thus contaminating the tomato plants. We feel that the geese and perhaps other avian species are contributing to the spread of Salmonella along the different waterways because they're able to pick up the Salmonella and transfer it from water, body of water to another body of water. So I want to switch gears and move on to talk about some of the colonization and internalization work that we have been doing. So basically, for these studies, we are trying to evaluate various routes of internalization of Salmonella, so through the root system, through the leaves, and through the blossoms. There's been a lot of work published on this, but the studies aren't necessarily consistent from one study to another, so we wanted to look at all of these under the same conditions. We also want to see if there's any sort of niche fitness for certain Salmonella cerevars. So basically, not only did we look at each individual system, the root system, the leaves, and the blossom, we also used a 5 cerevar cocktail, and we looked to see which cerevar was most fit in which niche, so in the soil, in the leaves, or in the blossoms. All of these studies, because of course we are working with infectious Salmonella, were done in environmental growth chambers. Because of the limited size of the growth chamber, we had to use a variety of tomato called a microtome, and this is really all the bigger that the tomato plant gets, which is just a few inches high. And you can see that we grow grow the tomatoes and then harvest them so that we can test them. And then this would have also been done with leaves and with blossoms. The picture just shows with tomatoes here. So what did we see? We saw that Salmonella is able to survive in all of these environments, the soil, the leaves, and the blossom. It does have some die-off, and that is to be expected. Whenever you look at the different cerevars in each of these environments, you do see that some cerevars do not do as well. For example, Typhimerium does not do very well in any of these environments. However, other cerevars seem to do well in the soil, such as Newport and Javiana. And Montevideo does very well in the blossom. So this is actually quite interesting. We are actually seeing cerevar differences in each of these micro niches within and around the tomato plant. Whenever we look specifically at the blossoms, if you inoculate blossoms, to see if the tomatoes were contaminated internally or externally, what we see is that it's both. With the exception of Salmonella typhimerium, which does not seem to survive very well whenever it is in this cocktail. It is simply outcompeted by these other organisms. But you can see that the Salmonella, whenever it is inoculated into the blossom, is capable of contaminating both the tomato on the inside and the surface. Whenever we look to see if the tomatoes or the Salmonella is able to invade the roots of the tomato, and this is actually a very interesting experiment. What is done is right after the Salmonella is inoculated into the soil at the same time as transplant, the plant is allowed to grow for a couple of days, at which time the stem is cut right above the surface of the soil. And then that is taken back to the lab, and 1 centimeter sections are sliced and placed onto an auger plate that allows us to see if Salmonella is growing there. And so what you see in this plate here, there's no Salmonella. We are looking for black. And this would be a control sample, where if you start here, this is the stem closest to the soil, and then you go up the stem, and we are not seeing any Salmonella. Here's one that has been planted into contaminated soil, and what we actually see is even starting right at the soil surface and then moving up the plant, the Salmonella has invaded the roots and made it up to the stem and has actually gone through up to the highest height that was tested. The other interesting thing here is we do see cerevar differences. Closer to the soil, we see Montevideo, but then as the Salmonella migrates up, we see more Newport. So this is actually very, very telling. The other thing that's quite interesting is if you look at these directly after transplant, you see a high percentage of them are positive for salmonella. However, if you wait and contaminate the soil 7 days after transplant, none of the plants are contaminated with salmonella. So this truly indicates that there is a window of opportunity here where we can control if you are able to prevent salmonella from being in the soil or at the root surface at the time of transplant for a short window of time, just 7 days, then the roots close and the salmonella is unable to invade. So just a quick summary of this. Salmonella is able to internalize into the tomato plants. The blossom is the most efficient, but followed by the root systems and then the leaves. The two key things affecting internalization are cerevar and plant stage. And then finally, we do see niche adaptation for the cerevars. So we see different cerevars capable of surviving in the soil versus the leaves versus the blossoms and then the tomato fruits. So what this might mean for the tomato industry is if you irrigate at the time of transplant with contaminated water, such as the pond waters that we found down there, this is a stage where salmonella is able to invade these tomato plants and then invade the tomatoes themselves. Blossoms may become contaminated during fumigations if you are using contaminated water at that stage, or the tomatoes can actually become contaminated from contact with contaminated leaves, and these may become contaminated once again during fumigation or perhaps even during the stringing and the staking of the plants. There's a lot of various stages where there's a lot of hands-on work that occurs with these tomato plants. So I realize that this is very brief and very quick overview of what we've been doing with all of our work in salmonella in tomatoes. And it takes a village to do all of this work, and here are many of the people that have helped out along the way. I do want to point out specifically Steve Rideout at Virginia Tech, who has allowed us graciously to come onto his field and take all the samples that we've been able to take. And if you have any questions, I will gladly answer them.
Yeah, this is Joan Murphy, Food Chemical News. So are these conditions in Florida and California? I mean, what is the big difference then?
Well, okay, so that's something that I've actually not had time to talk about here. So we have a whole other arm. There's many arms of this project. We have a whole other arm looking at the metagenomic analysis of the other microorganisms that are present in these environments. And we've looked at what is in Florida, what is in Virginia, and what is in California. And what we actually see is there are very drastic differences in the native microorganisms in these environments. For example, in California, we have a greater number of gram-positives, and gram-positives are known to produce inhibitors of gram-negatives, so especially the gram-negative enterics such as Salmonella and E. coli. But we do not see the same population of gram-positives in Virginia. We think part of this may be because of the fumigation that they must do to the soils before planting. And unfortunately, it's something that they're not going to be able to stop because of the fungal plant pathogens that are present in Virginia, and also, I believe, because of the nematodes that are present in Virginia, they have to do this soil fumigation to bring those numbers down.
Hi, Helena Bottomiller, Food Safety News. I'm just wondering if, I know this is, it's kind of hard to jump from the study you just did to recommendations, but what are the main takeaways? I mean, are you going to be able to recommend more water treatment I know they wouldn't be official recommendations, but what are the kinds of things that, that tomato growers could take away from this and actually apply?
Unfortunately, I'm not really the best person to answer that, because I do the research and I provide that then to our program offices. In my opinion, and this is my personal opinion, that probably water treatments, or especially looking at the stage of growth, just using potable water at the time of transplant, I think that is going to be very critical. But this is really, I really cannot be making any recommendations. That's just my opinion.
In just about, you know, melons and, you know, amphibians and chicks. And there's been so many salmonella outbreaks recently. Why did you just focus on tomatoes and not a lot of other vegetation? And also, kind of along the lines of the recommendations, what are consumers to do with the knowledge that there's this increase in salmonella or that it's happening? Is there any safe way to prepare melons, tomatoes, or...
that's kind of a big question. So why we focus on tomatoes? We see this recurring problem of tomato and salmonella coming out of the Eastern Shore since 2002. Even though things don't get elevated to an outbreak level, if you talk to the epidemiologists in Virginia, there are illnesses every year with this organism. And so this is something that looks bad, because we know that it happens almost yearly, and we don't know why, and we don't know how to prevent it. So that is why we're focusing on tomatoes. Melons... In all honesty, once again, my personal opinion, I don't know that at this point in time we have enough data to say what is going to make a safe melon. That's something that we're working on, that we need to do more with. Right now, because it came out of the blue, a lot of the work in melons is with Listeria. And that is going to be a big focus for us, because Listeria on produce is such a new thing, and we need to get ahead of that very quickly. As to what consumers can do, that is, I think there are some very good guidelines out there, but in all honesty, I don't have any good answers to that.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you also for the opportunity to speak here. My name is Bailey G. I'm a research microbiologist with FDA's Center for Veterinary Medicine Office of Research. Today, I'll be discussing with you about some ongoing research we have on developing rapid molecular methods for detecting salmonella in animal feed and pet food. This is a picture of our office. And CVM is headquartered in Rockville. Office of Research is located in Laurel, Maryland. And we have three divisions, residue chemistry, applied veterinary research, and animal and food microbiology. So all three divisions dealt with different aspect of applied research that to address ongoing and evolving regulatory issues associated with CVM concerns, regulated food and feed products. So first, some background information about salmonella. From Rebecca's talk, we already learned quite some salmonella serovars, where salmonella may be found in the water, in the produce. And salmonella is a gram-negative bacteria, which is rod-shaped. When we say gram-negative, which means when you apply gram stain, salmonella would appear pink under microscope. So the picture to your left is how salmonella looks like under a laboratory media. So it looks like a black on that media. And the picture to your left is how salmonella looks like under electron microscope. So it is rod-shaped, and it also has some flagella which is, looks like hair-like structures come out of the bacterial body. So Salmonella is quite a diverse organism. So far, there are over 2,500 serovars identified. So as Rebecca mentioned, there are some Salmonella typhimurium, Salmonella Newport, Salmonella enteritidis. So those are all Salmonella serovars has been identified. Salmonella lives in the intestinal tract of warm and cold-blooded animals. Unfortunately, in sometimes Salmonella may get into food and feed, cause problems in human. The human illness caused by Salmonella is called salmonellosis, so which is a term to define Salmonella illness in human. As a matter of fact, Salmonella is a leading cause of foodborne illness in the United States. According to a recent CDC report, each year there are estimated 1 million cases of illnesses caused by Salmonella, 19,000 hospitalization, and 378 deaths. So those are the each year estimated number caused by Salmonella. The symptoms caused by Salmonella generally falls into two categories. One is gastroenteritis, which basically is a classical foodborne infection, which including nausea, diarrhea, abdominal pain, and cramping. And another category of symptoms caused by salmonellosis is much more severe, which means Salmonella goes into your bloodstream and may affect your other organs that include meningitis and also bacteremia, sometimes also reactive arthritis. So the picture shown here is Salmonella invading the human intestinal cells. So when that happens, it may go into your entire system, cause problems. So this figure is give you an overview about foodborne disease infection rates of major foodborne pathogens in the United States. This is conducted by CDC FoodNet data. As we can tell from 1996, Campylobacter is the one leading the pack right on the top. And around 2001, Salmonella started to take the lead. And this trend hasn't been changed. So over this many years, Salmonella trend hasn't changed much, didn't go down that much. Actually, we also see a little bit growth, a little bit increase around this trend. So in terms of reservoirs and vehicles of Salmonella transmission in human, so mainly we talked about Salmonella lives in the intestinal tract of cold and warm-blooded animals. As a matter, as a result, animals are major reservoir for Salmonella, which include poultry, cattle, and also we have pets. Those pets and also other amphibians and reptiles. So those are all possible reservoirs for Salmonella. And in terms of food vehicles for Salmonella transmission, that will be animal food, including poultry and meat and eggs. Poultry and eggs and meat products, and also a whole range of produce. That could be a problem for Salmonella. And very recently, we have a mango outbreak, and also even in hedgehogs. So Salmonella was causing problem in those animals and also food. So at CVM, we are more interested in looking at those affecting animals and animal foods. So those are talking about human outbreaks involving animals and animal foods. So CDC actually maintains a very nice outbreak database. And from here, so I just want to quickly take you to a CDC database which look at Salmonella outbreaks. So they highlighted some important Salmonella outbreak there. It would be a good source for people who are interested in looking at Salmonella issues. So here, they summarize the outbreak investigation of major Salmonella outbreaks here. You can see there are a whole range of things has been involved in Salmonella outbreaks. So including the recent hedgehog outbreak, mango, cantaloupe, and also you see a cluster of live poultry related outbreak, and we have dry dog foods involved in Salmonella outbreaks. So this list goes down until since 2006, you can find all major salmonella-related outbreak there. So let's go back to the slides. So in this table, I summarize a couple of animal food-related salmonella outbreaks. So in this live poultry cluster outbreak, which is happening in 2012, we already have 163 cases. So those are the human got sick from playing with live poultry. 33 hospitalizations and 2 deaths from that outbreak. And this affecting 26 states. And similarly, you would see other outbreak is also affecting multiple states. And the food involved, the animal food involved would be dry dog food. And we also have a dry pet food involved in the outbreak. We also have other kind of small pets, pet turtle, chicks, ducklings. So this is an issue in, salmonella is an issue in animals and animal foods. So as part of the surveillance at CVM, Office of Surveillance and Compliance, they conduct a regular survey of salmonella in animal feed and pet food. So this is the data from 2002 to 2009. So the feed type are break into different categories, and the bottom two are the pet food category. So you can tell the prevalence of salmonella in animal feed between 2002 and 2006 range from 0% to 30%. And it seems the rate goes down in recent years. Now the rate is from 0 to 19% in animal feed. And pet food rate is smaller. So in early years, it's around 12 to 18%, and in recent years, it dropped to 6 to 7%. Even though the rate appears to be dropping and because of the outbreaks and also some other human health concerns and animal health concerns, it is still very important to address salmonella contamination issues in animal feed and pet food. In that regard, it's very important to develop a rapid method so people can screen for those commodities and to identify salmonella in those products. So in terms of current CVM thinking on salmonella in animal feed, so those are the two guidance CVM has published. One is regarding direct human contact feed. That will be the pet food, and also those animal feed used for petting zoo. That's where people will come direct into contact with those feed types. And we would also have another category called feed for food producing animals. So those would be cattle farm or cattle ranches, and those would be handled by farmers. So the issue with those have separate issues. For direct human contact food, we are more concerned about human health issues. So contamination with any salmonella serovirus would be considered as adulteration. So when you find a salmonella in any of those direct pet food, and they would be considered as adulteration if you don't incorporate further kill steps to eliminate those. However, on feed for food-producing animals, the current CVM recommendation, we are only concerned about contamination with salmonella serovirus of health concern to target animals. So here, animal health is at a major play rather than human health. And on the other hand, because those food animals eventually will pass through the food chain, so we still need to have a good method to be able to reduce the salmonella contamination in those commodities. So the objective of our study is to develop a rapid, specific, and sensitive molecular-based method for salmonella detection in animal feed and pet food. So the method we are going to using is called LAMP. So I'm going to introduce that in a minute. We also want to compare this assay with reference method. That will be FDA BAM method and also some PCR and qPCR method, as Rebecca has been talking about. And we're also going to validate the assay in multiple FDA laboratories. So this is a overview of current detection method. Basically, they can be grouped into three categories. One is culture-based, basically use bacterial media in the laboratory to conduct growth of the bacteria and try to isolate them from a mix of food, commodity, or environmental samples. And those methods are considered a good standard for bacterial culture. As FDA regulation, we have to have a culture isolate in hand to be able to actually do some regulatory enforcement. However, culture-based methods are quite lengthy. You generally take days or weeks to get a good result. And the second group of assay would be considered as immunological-based method. So those methods are using antigen and antibody binding to be able to recognize a bacterial pathogen of concern. Immunological-based methods generally are not standalone methods. They can be used during the isolation process to help you capture the organism of concern, or they can be used after you already have isolates to confirm whether that's the pathogen of concern you're looking at. The third group of methods is called molecular-based method. Those has been gaining popularity in the past decade, like a PCR method. This small instrument here is a PCR machine. So what PCR does is basically in a short amount of time, generally 2 to 3 hours, you amplify your target DNA. They can reach around millions of cells, so millions of DNA copies. So you start with one copy. In 2 hours, you will get millions of copies. So that largely increases your signal. So that signal can be detected by either you run the sample on a gel, or you can run them real time through fluorescence change in the machine. So the method we are interested in doing is a pretty novel method called molecular. It's called loop-mediated isothermal amplification. So this method was developed in 2000 and was by a group of Japanese investigators. Since the development, this method has gained popularity in other countries, primarily in Japan, and also other developing countries. However, in the U.S., the use of this method is pretty, it's not as popular until quite recently. So the LAMP method works, it is also a DNA amplification method. Same as PCR, it can increase your target DNA copies in relatively short amount of time. So the LAMP can be divided into three major steps. The first is called initiation. So you have some special design primers. So that those are the primer 1, 2, 3, 4. So those are short DNA sequence that helps to initiate the amplification. And that the long strand is your target. So once those primers bind to your target, then they are going to form a dump well structure. So this structure will be the initial point for future exponential amplification. So once this dump well structure is formed, your DNA can be amplified exponentially, even in a faster speed than PCR. So in generally, you run LAMP in about 1 hour, you can get 1 billion copies. So that's 10 to 9 copies. In comparison, PCR, you generally take 2 to 3 hours, you get millions of copies. So I do have an animation here. It's like 1 minute. So you can see how LAMP in action, you know, how it's actually amplify your DNA target. So it just takes a few steps at the beginning to generate a dump bell structure. And once the dump bell is formed, each one of those dump bell can serve as a starting point for amplification. So in a short amount of time, your DNA gets exponentially amplified, which generates billions of copies and largely increase your signal for detection. So this basically is a rough introduction about LAMP. And advantage of LAMP, as I mentioned, it is quite rapid. And generally, LAMP assay was run in 1 hour. And you sometimes can see a positive result within 15 minutes of amplification. And LAMP is pretty simple. The setup is not different from PCR. And a good, a big advantage of LAMP is that it is isothermal method, so which means you don't need a dedicated PCR machine. You can run LAMP in the water bus. You know, you can also run it in a simple heater in the lab. So those all can be platforms for running LAMP assays. Because of the rapid amplification of DNA copies, LAMP is pretty sensitive. It is also very specific. So the specificity was ensured by those primers. And LAMP has four to six primers. Comparison PCR, in general, they only have two primers. So the more primer ensures more LAMP to be more specific. LAMP is also robust. As we all know, some of the food samples and feed samples, they would have some inhibitors because they some have environmental samples. And those inhibitors may affect the PCR performance. And a couple of studies has shown that LAMP is more robust than PCR. So it seems to be more tolerant to those inhibitors in your real-world samples, like food or feed, or environmental samples. And LAMP is inexpensive, and the reagents is not much different from PCR. It doesn't need a probe. And another good advantage of LAMP is that the way LAMP result can be read. So there are three ways you can read the LAMP result. One is through turbidity change. Because of the large amount of DNA generated by LAMP, you can actually see the tube is turning turbid after the reaction is completed. And the second way you can do it is you can look it under normal light. You would see the positive result showing light yellow color. Oh, sorry. Those are the green color, are the greenish yellow are the positive result. A negative result would be remains yellow. And to read more, even more clearly, you can read your tubes under UV light. You will see the positive result with the fluorescence bright green, and the negative result would remain dark under UV light. So this is an easy way to read your results. And when combined with a real-time turbidity meter, LAMP can be quantitative, so which means in a laboratory setting, you can actually quantify the amount of DNA generated in real time. So as the DNA is generated, you can read how much is there, and you would be able to tell if there is a positive result or how much initial copies your sample start with. So that's called a quantitative ability. So I actually came to, not so long ago, I just joined FDA recently. I was a faculty member at Louisiana State University. At LSU, we did quite some work with LAMP. We actually is a leading laboratory in the US on applying LAMP in detecting foodborne pathogens. So here are some papers we published on LAMP. We started with a pathogen, which is actually pretty severe pathogen in seafood. So it's Vibrio parahemolyticus and Vibrio vinificus, parahemolyticus and vinificus. So we examined the LAMP detection of these two pathogens in raw oysters. And following that, we also did a LAMP detection of Salmonella in produce. And then recently, we did a LAMP, we developed LAMP assays for detecting Shiga toxin producing E. coli, also in sometimes in produce and also in ground beef and other commodities, other sample types. So all of those papers are published in well-recognized microbiological journals. So from there, with me on board with CVM, I would like to bring this assay up to speed in detecting animal feed and pet food commodities. So what we learned from LAMP, from developing those LAMP assays is that they are really a rapid assay. Sometimes a positive result, you can see it within 15 minutes. So in comparison with PCR, real-time PCR, you generally would require at least 1 hour to get a result. And also, LAMP has excellent inclusivity and exclusivity. When we say that, it means if you use a group of bacteria, which are your target organism, you would get a positive result. And however, if you include a group of bacteria which are non-target, they would be excluded from this assay. So there's no false positive or false negative resulted from the assay. The assay is quite sensitive, which means you can detect down to one cell, and sometimes it's around 20 cells. That's considered pretty sensitive in a food detection area. And it is also quite quantitative. Sometimes it can be quantitative. So if you are looking at this relationship between your cell number, this is your cell concentration, and this is a signal. So they have a pretty linear relationship, so which means they can, based on the signal generated, you can quantify how many your initial DNA was. And the cost of lamp or running a lamp assay from sample preparation until complete the assay is about $2 to $3 per sample. So this is a flow chart for the procedures to apply lamp in feed samples. So on the left part shows the procedure of each step. On the right part is an estimated time to devote it to each step. So we start with a sample preparation. We would use a feed sample, which we know that they are negative for Salmonella to start with. So we would artificially inoculate Salmonella into this pet food samples, and then we homogenize them. So we subject them into enrichment for 4 hour, 6 hour, up to 24 hour enrichment. After enrichment, we would conduct DNA extraction. So this is a laboratory procedure which takes about 15 minutes to extract DNA from the enrichment sample. And from there, we would subject this into LAMP. So this is a small instrument I mentioned. It's called real-time turbidity meter, which provide exact turbidity readings so you can know how your assay is performing along the way. It also provide a real-time quantification of your sample result. So this takes about 45 minutes. So this over here is a complete picture of the machine. And after your amplification, you can read your end result through this UV light, under UV light turbidity reading, or you can read it real time through this machine. So here's some data we got from Salmonella LAMP application in feed samples. So what we did here is that we applied the sample into 4 hour enrichment, 6 hour enrichment, 8, 12, and 24 hour enrichment. As you can tell, when you apply the sample, the amount of cell we inoculate into the sample is about 2 cells per feed sample. So as you can tell, the 4 hour enrichment, which is a black line here, you actually do not have samples, you do not have signals. So which means the amount of cells in the samples are not sufficient to be able to detect it. And this has largely to do with the dilution factors you apply during the food detection, and also the amount of food and the amount of liquid you can actually apply to your assay. So after 6 hour enrichment, you clearly to see positive signals resulting from LAMP. In comparison, we also included a PCR. And many times PCR would have a hard time to detect a 6 hour enrichment sample at inoculated at 2 cells per 25 gram of feed samples. But after 8 hour, 10 hour, 12 hour, 24 hour, the LAMP, both LAMP and the qPCR were able to consistently detect your sample when they are enriched for that many hours. So based on what I discussed today, Salmonella LAMP is a rapid, sensitive, specific, yet it is a technical, simple, and a cost-effective detection tool. We hope through further validation, this could be adopted for routine screening of Salmonella in animal feed and pet food. So finally, I want to acknowledge a group of people. Those are people at LSU who did all those assay development and validation in different products. And those are the CIFSON collaborators who would be carry out some of the further validation in different FDA laboratories. And here are our DEFA, Division of Animal Food Microbiologist at CVM Office of Research. And Dr. Jiang Hongmeng is my University of Maryland collaborator, some of the researcher funded by Center for Produce Safety.